I get very excited that it's hard for me to discern who is like a Silicon Valley founder versus someone that's in a different part of the world, right? They all essentially look the same now in terms of the quality of the pitch. And that gets me so excited that like, it's not necessarily an activity that's localized to our region in the San Francisco Bay Area where the three of us live, but that Silicon Valley, I think, is really extended across the rest of the world. It's more of like a mindset. So seeing that trend makes me enormously happy because I'd love to see more builders all around the world.
Guests and hosts drink on this show, and we ask that if you join us, you be of legal age and you drink responsibly. Number two, if you want to know about check size, stage, similar questions, this is the wrong podcast for you. On Drinks with a VC, we're all about digging a little bit deeper and getting to know the person behind the investment decisions.
Thank you for joining us on whatever platform you're using. A quick reminder to please like, subscribe, and leave a review where possible. Hello, and welcome to Drinks with a VC. I am Vic LaQuara, the co-founder and managing director of seed stage fund Green Cow Venture Capital. And I am joined by my co-hostess with the mostest, Bree Hansen, who leads up business development for Berklin and Associates. I am very excited to be introducing our next guest. I've actually really been fortunate because it's because of Bree and Ren and the good folks at Berklin that I've gotten to know Eric over the last months and during the pandemic. I think two things absolutely stand out when you meet Eric. The first is that he's absolutely selfless. Did I even say that right? Selfless with his time and his network. And he really does give without asking for anything in return. And the second thing is that he's a total open book and he's super genuine. Right from the get-go, I think, you know, we have so much fun together because of the fact that I think we have the same sense of humor, but we also have very similar backgrounds as products of immigrants. And so I've just had such a fantastic time getting to know him. He actually hails from the Midwest in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. He went to Stanford for both his undergrad and his master's. He's an edtech entrepreneur multiple times over. He's a world traveler. He's been a PM at Instagram. He's an EIR venture partner at 500 Startups. And now he's the co-founder and managing director of pre-seed venture fund Hustle Fund alongside his partners Elizabeth Yin and Xian Ko. So please welcome Eric Bond to the show. Eric. Hi.
Hey, thank you so much for this opportunity, Vic. Appreciate that super kind introduction there. Bree, good to see you. Ren and Josh, awesome to have you online too. That you made me look really nice, probably nicer than I'm actually in real life. So appreciate that, Vic.
No, that's total bullshit. You are that nice offline in real life, in IRL. So cheers to that.
Oh, thank it's you true. So much. Yeah, but I thought that this concept of Drunk History meets VC interviewing, utterly brilliant. So congrats to you, Vic, and the Berklin team for coming up with this. And I appreciate the boost too that you gave me.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you drinking, by the way? What are we drinking tonight?
Well, yesterday, Ren, who is on Bree's team at Berklin, was kind enough to drop off this Basil Hayden's. It's one of my favorite sipping whiskeys, my bourbon. So I'm enjoying just a nice, neat glass of this and a Berklin purchased Glencairn glass as well with a drop of water.
Love it. Bree, are you doing it also neat with a little bit of water?
You know, I actually made it the way you kind of sent me that Basil Hayden Aperol.
Yes.
So I made a little cocktail for myself because we had the Aperol Spritz at Brandon Farwell's. So I have a whole bottle of Aperol just waiting to be used.
Good for you.
And now I get to mix it with whiskey like we do on every call. Now I get to bring the one time we didn't drink whiskey to the other times we are drinking whiskey.
That's fantastic. Yeah, we're connecting the dots here. For all of the listeners out there, 3/4 part Aperol, 3/4 part was it vermouth and then a full part of the bourbon whiskey of your choice, along with a little bit of a garnish of orange. And you've got what we call a Basil Hayden's Bombardier. First of all, I think we have to say congrats, Eric, because a month ago, Hustle Fund announced their $30 million Hustle Fund 2. Is that right?
$33.6 million. Don't forget that extra 3.6. But yes, thank you so much.
That's fantastic. The extra 3.6 goes a long way because you're doing pre-seed investing and you're writing checks from 25K up, right? And that's so, you know, how are things going right now?
Yeah, so it's been year three and a half. We started Hustle Fund back in 2017. As you pointed out, it's a fund that focuses on pre-seed stage investing. So typical co-investors, when we write our first checks, are like your mom, your aunt, a couple of VC institutions, but we try to really come in alongside that round. So we actually had a really cool milestone, which we celebrated in very good VC fashion in a tweet on Friday, just 2 days ago, which is we just reviewed our 10,000th deal at Hustle Fund on our Airtable. So seeing a lot of really awesome founder engagement, it's a real blessing to be in this work, to serve founders this early. So exciting stuff, but just 3.5, you know, so just recently got potty trained, you know, consistently sleeping through the night, but occasional accidents. Yes. It's kind of a good way of describing, I think, where we are in our life cycle right now.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of growing up, right, in 2014, you wrote this article, and I believe it was called Calculating When You Can Say F You. And
oh, yeah. Wow, you read that.
We read the whole thing. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, post-pandemic and now 2 kids later, a 6 and a 2-year-old, is it time to reevaluate what that FU number is for yourself?
Yeah. So some context there, which I didn't expect Vic and Bree to be this good at their stalking, but I did write a blog post about FU numbers, which is this concept, which I guess in maybe more politically correct parlance is like this notion of financial independence, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that if you work, it's really through the choice of working on whatever projects you want versus working for the paycheck to, you know, survive. And was really lucky. So when I wrote that, that was when I was exiting my first company. We had just sold 2 years previous to that, went mm-hmm. through the integration, got some modest financial independence out of that. But like the idea behind it was just more of like a celebration of, you know, this is what it kind of feels like to, you know, have choices. It's actually not just like this, I can't remember what the article is about, but it is very liberating. But the other hand of it too is just like assuming that choices are also kind of scary at times. But now that I have 2 kids, I can tell you this, which is I think I deeply, deeply underestimate how expensive it is to have children. So supporting like a husband and wife that's like relatively like, you know, able-bodied and, you know, kind of cheap, it's one thing. But then having 2 dozen little dudes and dudettes or whatever the mix is with their respective lives, like it's a thing, you know, like those nannies ain't cheap, childcare ain't cheap. So that said, like, I think we're still pretty lucky in our situation, but there's, I think, a kind of like a time scarcity that I think I feel quite a bit. That's a very different kind of thing from financial independence or financial scarcity. So a lot of my time is just trying to figure out like, how can I balance being a good husband, dad, but also being really effective in my job. And I think it's just a long journey ahead to try to find that balance.
What are the secrets that you've learned or that you've adopted thus far?
To try to find some semblance of balance?
Yeah, to find that balance.
You know, when you have a kid who's, let's say, less than a year old and can't really communicate with you, there's really just a very simple balance that you're trying to achieve in making this child happy. It's like, did they get enough sleep? Right? Did they get enough exercise? And also, did they eat enough? Yeah. And it turns out that those are the 3 things that really matter for adults too. So if you can solve for really good sleep, really good exercise, really good food, largely, you know, you can get creative, like have like full faculties to try to be flexible when it comes to work, being really present at home. But when I'm lacking one of those 3 pillars, you know, this is where things get really messy. It's just like, oh, I'm still thinking about work when I'm hanging out with the kids and so forth. So it's just those 3 basic things that I think we try to solve for in this family that's been working out pretty well. And then also just celebrating the fact that, you know, because my wife also runs her own business and I run my own business, we can largely dictate when we spend our time working. So, so that's really fun too, because if I want to spend the afternoon with my kids, I can make up for it in different ways at work or with my wife and so forth. So, you know, I think this has kind of like been the big joy about since like achieving that, like very somewhat douchey, like a financial independence blog post that I wrote many years ago, is just being able to like control how I spend my time, I think is also very important for how we're organizing our family and work.
Yeah. And by the way, I actually don't think it was douchey at all. Bree, I'm sure you can weigh in on this as well, but I think there's nothing wrong with understanding financial independence and having an evolving understanding of financial independence, right? That's something I think that more people can probably learn from.
I think about that all the time. and it's actually sometimes advice that I give to people is the advice you gave in your blog, because you do have to look at it from that perspective. So I don't think it was douchey.
Yeah. Shameless plug. What if someone wants to read the blog post, where can they go to read it?
You can go to my personal blog, which I have not updated in a couple of years. It's called lifeafterliquidity.com. Yeah. So initially it started off as like a travel blog that my wife and I were contributing to when we took some time off in 2014 to travel the world. And so there's a lot of travel stuff there too, but I talk about kind of financial independence as well. Right around that time, just a little side context, is I started to really get into personal finance blogs. So like Mr. Money Mustache and J.L. Collins, there's a couple of these like prominent writers that have become pretty popular in subsequent years, really, really influenced me. And travel did too, because I realized that A, I never really thought too deeply about what does actually financial independence actually mean? Like, how do you achieve it? How much do you actually need? Yeah. And then I think the second part too is just like really reassessing like what the definition of a rich life, right? Mm. It's not necessarily like cars and big houses if you don't really care about that stuff. It's really just more around, of course, being able to really, really control your time, right? Yeah. I mean, clearly in my garage here, but this is actually like my definition of wealth, which is just like, I have the space to myself. I got this nice, healthy family.
Well, so for the view, you know, for the folks that are just listening and not viewing it on YouTube, I just want to point out that Eric probably has the most organized looking garage I have ever seen. And the only thing that is really kind of messing it up are the gifts in the boxes that we sent him. So I honestly feel like, it seems like a ringing endorsement, not for minimalism, but for leading a very organized kind of experience first life rather than, you know, hoarding of things like a lot of garages kind of look like typically.
That really speaks my heart. Thank you for that compliment, because this garage is my sacred space, right? So I'm going to tell you a little secret here, though. It was really a seriously messy like shit show for most of this time. But our friend is actually a Marie Kondo consultant. And she actually came here and helped us to organize our entire house. The garage was actually the most important project for me personally. So there's a before and after picture somewhere, but it's a lot better now than it was before. And I do spend the majority of my day here actually during the weekdays.
And you do, I mean, you really do work out of the garage. You've got the podcast that you film from the garage. And so you're there.
Yeah, I love it here. I mean, actually, as I know that your viewers can't, or the listeners can't necessarily see this, but I'm actually standing on a treadmill right now. So I can do my treadmill, some little bit of light cardio when I'm working for most of the day. Usually out of respect for founders, I pause the movement, and for this podcast too.
Okay.
So, you know, it doesn't look crazy, but I got like my nice condenser microphone here and like all the stuff for work. And yeah, I mean, like it's like a hacker space. This is a lot like the offices that I had as a younger founder, right? So it's nice to be back in my normal element here.
I love it. I love it. So let's go from your happy place to not so happy of a place.
Yeah, very dark place.
To a very not a dark place. I think recently you tweeted that you woke up and you had a really sad morning, and that sometimes it's hard to focus on work when you know there are people out there who would love to harm you or see you die. And you sent love to the BIPOC community, members and allies. And I, first of all, how are you? Because I didn't ask you when we popped on, and it has been a pretty tumultuous and heartbreaking time for all of Asian Americans, really. But how are you? That's the question.
Thanks for asking. I think that I'm doing better than most, honestly.
Yeah.
Namely because I have a lot of the basics covered in my life, but also other resources too. Like I see a therapist, yeah. I have like mental health resources. My wife is a life coach, so she's got very specific training as well as a partner to help coach me through some of these things too. I think here's what it comes down to. There's, the thing that's been going in my mind is as someone that lives in the Bay Area as an Asian American, it's very easy to be caught up in the privilege that we often enjoy here, which is, there's so many Asians here and they're in various levels of leadership and tech. So it can feel very normalized actually to just, keep your head down, work and say that's other people's problem when they've encountered violence or discrimination and so forth. But these kinds of moments really do bring back an acute kind of reminder that there's a really long way to go. I mean, like the BIPOC community should be something that, we just across the diaspora just have each other's backs. Yeah. And I think the problem that I think with being an Asian American here is that in the model minority myth, there's like this notion of, we have some level of proximity to whiteness actually in terms of how we're treated in society. It's not all the way there, but because of it, we're kind of trained implicitly not to ever complain. If there's racism against you, or especially if one of our other members of the BIPOC community that does not have that kind of similar proximity to whiteness, Latinx people, Black people are harmed, right?
Yeah.
So I think just from the past year, all the way from George Floyd to present, like there's like a lot of questions I've been personally kind of asking myself of, am I doing enough to stand up for my brothers and sisters across the diaspora? Is my lived experience like how is that actually different from my Black friends and Latinx friends who probably feel 10x worse every day, right? So those are the like big existential questions about society I've been thinking about. And it makes me really sad because on the very extreme end of it are certainly a portion of the population that would have nothing more joy than to see folks like myself, others in this community out of America, right? Yeah. So there's no good answer to this. I think it's just... we have a lot of work to do, but, redefining what it means to be an ally for myself is something that I'm actively working through. Just like what next then? Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, Bree as a woman in tech has dealt with a lot of misogyny.
Of course.
Since 9/11, I was at college in New York when 9/11 happened and dealing with the xenophobia associated with that. And even to this day, right? And Asian Americans, it might not always take this outrageous, visceral form that it's taken the last several weeks. The subtle racism, underlying racism is something that I think we've all dealt with that impact over my career and my life really, and I'm sure you feel the same way. I think the interesting thing that you point out here is like this model minority aspect, right? And both you and I feel like we're somehow the same in a sense that even on your bio, right? It's like your parents wish you were a doctor. My dad wishes I was a systems architect. It's hard to say, look at all this racism that we've endured when, our families struggled through poverty, came here, built stuff, gave us these amazing lives. We deal with privilege too. And so I think there's a little bit of an inherent kind of paradox between the two of them that I think you and I certainly are very familiar with, when you shared your moment of privilege, I think that was very eye-opening. And if anyone gets a chance, check out Eric's Twitter. He's got it pinned, his story of growing up in privilege. And I think what was the most eye-opening was, and what I was so thankful about, was the fact that you had other white investors then share their story, and it kind of pushed them to kind of share and look at it and really take a look at that privilege. So I really would encourage people to check that out. Can you talk a little bit about how we as investors can do better and what we can do in particular to kind of push that privilege and the bias that we might have inherently when we invest?
Sure. So I think let's start kind of a little bit more broad, which is, you know, one of the things that we believe at our fund, and I think actually newer emerging managers also agree on, is this mantra that we have at Hustle Fund, which is that great hustlers look like anyone and come from anywhere. Mm-hmm. Full stop. There's been a long time trope in the last several decades that the very best founders actually fit a very, very narrow phenotype and pedigree background. Like white or Asian men went to Stanford, computer science degree, worked at a Google or Facebook, wears a Patagonia vest, Allbirds shoes, like all that stuff, right? There's like a very specific narrow trope of men lives in San Francisco, like that has like, I guess, propagated for quite some time. Sure. And when we look at the data ourselves before we start Hustle Fund, we could not find any convincing data to indicate that just because you possess these phenotypes, literally factors of like how you physically look, as well as these pedigree backgrounds, it doesn't necessarily correlate to predicting winning outcomes every time. Because great hustlers look like anyone and can come from anywhere. It's certainly possible that those who do not possess those phenotypes, women, underrepresented groups outside Silicon Valley, can actually succeed and build huge unicorn companies. So I think like if there's actually that first fundamental belief, which is if you want to make a lot of money, create like as inclusive a funnel as possible so that everyone wants to just talk to you. And then just as a motivated capitalist, you have better choices in figuring out who's got the best talent and best markets and just give them money. That's, I think, a step in the right direction. But with regard to like privilege, you know, I was talking to a Black female founder in our portfolio, and I asked her, you know, what is like the highest leverage thing that I can do to just help you in your journey? And her answer was really simple. And this is something that just has stuck with me this entire time in building Hustle Fund, which is, I'm good, but all I need is to use your privilege as my own, right? It's just like, she knows how to build a great company. She's a really fast learner, but it's just like my network, the way that I look, that allows me to get into certain kinds of doors and conversations. She wants that for herself. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was like the most elegant description of what allyship could look like for us as VCs, which is use my privilege for your own gain and just do your work. Right.
Yeah.
I loved that when I heard that.
Yeah. I think that's fantastic. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think people are so excited about Hustle Fundraising Fund 2 and a bigger fund at that, because you're at the pre-seed stage where it's so vital, because without your capital and without the fact that you don't have blinders in that sense, some of these folks don't make it to the next stage. Right. And even having the, you know, Eric and Elizabeth kind of seal of approval as an investment for us seed stage investors, you know, that goes a long way, right? And so I think it's really valuable. I think that's fantastic.
Well, I mean, just to riff on that comment too, Vic. So it is getting better in some ways. So when I was a founder for the last 15 years pitching to VCs, I generally had a terrible opinion of all of them. It was just like a really unwelcome group. Like it felt like I was just begging for cash, which I literally was.
Yeah.
But the newer managers, and I include yourself, Bree, a lot of the folks that you work with too at Berkland, I think are coming in with a different social contract, right? Yeah. Like a comment that you had made, I think possibly before we started recording earlier, Vic, was just like, you know, working with founders is really similar as a marriage, right? Because it's like a decade long kind of commitment that you're making.
Yeah.
And just even the fact that you're framing it like that way, I think says a lot about your own values, which I see increasingly represented across our emerging manager sisters and brothers, which is just like, we don't want to just be hitting like Patagonia vest sales and like, you know, buying those up and just like you sitting on the opposite side of my table at Sand Hill, just like acting like the same jerks in previous life. Like, it's really about like, how can we better serve you, you know, be like almost like a more service oriented relationship. And I think just like the newer class emerging managers, especially, and there's some old school ones that are starting to get around to this too, but just really, really understand and appreciate that kind of working style, right? Yeah. So I think it's a better environment already, but yeah, still lots of work to be done. So much.
Yeah. You know, there's always that visualization or graph that shows kind of the number of founders that came from each top school, right? Stanford, yeah, on down the line.
Of course.
When you look at that, even though you're a Stanford alum, I get that. Do you see, hey, there's a lot of opportunity not in those schools, not from those schools? Because a lot of times, and I'll be very honest, as an emerging manager, people are always saying, look, do you have your hooks into those schools, right? The Stanfords, yeah, and the Harvards and the Cornells, et cetera, of the world. And as an emerging manager, we're trying to make a name for ourselves. We often look at pedigree, and sometimes people just have to fall back on pedigree, right? And say, okay, you know, solid investments. And this is, we do have, you know, our network does span all of these companies and all of these universities. How do we, as earlier, you know, stage managers and the new guard of venture capital, how do we combat that, right? Like those two, yeah, competing ideas.
I think what I'll do to try to answer this is by tell you like a super quick story. Okay. Yeah. So many years ago, I was product manager at Instagram. And if people can't see this, I'm actually wearing my old Instagram t-shirt right now. Didn't realize I was wearing it for this call. So we were trying to hire for a senior engineer in our team. And this recruiter sent me this resume of this guy who had a computer science degree from Princeton, computer science degree, a master's from Carnegie Mellon, had been working at Google for 7 years. So on paper, I was like, this guy looks amazing. Let's bring him in. Mm-hmm. Well, we brought him in a couple of weeks later to interview, and he walks in and like immediately I'm impressed. Just, he didn't even say anything. I was just like, this dude is really handsome. He looked like he just like jumped out of a Patagonia catalog page. Just like tall, handsome white guy, Patagonia vest, Allbirds shoes, great smile, just like looked very impressive, right? And then he started to open his mouth and talk. And I'm like, holy shit, this guy has it. I mean, articulate, great at pitching himself, super witty, just seemed like someone that would be really fun to work with, you know, day in, day out, day in and day out. So like we did what we normally do at any company. You put this person on an interview loop.
Sure.
So that the colleagues will have a chance to weigh in too. So we got in front of six other engineers on our team. Everyone came back saying like, this guy is amazing. We have to hire him. And that's exactly what we did. And so he came in a couple of weeks later after accepting our offer, started working with us. And in about 2 weeks, that's all it took for us to realize that we had made a horrible, horrible hiring mistake. Yeah. So what happened, right? On paper, this guy pitched us super well about himself. And two things emerged when we began to actually execute alongside of him. First is he was super arrogant. So maybe that was my bad. Perhaps my back channeling was terrible or something. But when you began to work with him, you realize how uncoachable he is and pretty set in his ways. So that was one part, maybe somewhat forgivable. But the second sin was bigger, which was he was super slow. So it turns out that when you're working on Gmail, you're not changing the product that often. Like it's a pretty mature product. It's like, you know, 20 years old at this point, I think, at least,
sure,
or close to it. And like, so at Instagram, the team that I was running, because it was me running this portion of the team, we had no idea what we were doing. So it was frenetic. We were doing daily releases of this machine learning thing that we were doing. And it was a crazy kind of pace. He could just never catch up. So it took us a couple of months to get rid of him. And I think he's still at Facebook even to this day, many years later. But the reason why I like to share this story is it's illustrative in our view of the current state of pre-seed and seed stage investing. Mm. You know, when you're dealing with teams this early, if it's like Vic and Bree pitching us, usually the product is still sort of prototype phase. There's definitely no product market fit. The traction is negligible in a lot of cases. Sometimes it's there, but sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
You really don't have that much to judge. So you can't take like the questions that you ask at series A or B or whatever and apply them at the pre-seed stage. Really our jobs at this moment is to assess the potential of the teams and try to make our best investments. So the current way of doing this is treating the pitch as an interview loop. It's like, we talk a couple times. I talk to my partners. I'm like, yo, Bree and Vic are amazing. Let's give them $250,000 and then let's pray for it to work out. That's sort of like the traditional way of making investments in the space. Our view though is that in order for us to understand what we think is the best leading indicator success in teams that's discernible at the early stage, which is called hustle. Hustle for us is defined as great execution meets high velocity. We need to have a mechanism to work with those teams for some period of time. So the way that we do this is we start with a small $25,000 check into a lot of teams. In our current fund too, we're doing this 200 times over the course of 3 years. So roughly 70 deals per year. We'll then work with each team on a growth project for 4 to 8 weeks, usually related to sales or user acquisition. So each general partner on our team has started, scaled, and sold the company with heavy emphasis on sales. And this is an area that we love to talk about and teach. And it's from this period of time where the true due diligence happens. We're working with the teams. We're seeing how they execute. And also reciprocally, the teams are seeing how we execute as a fund. And in about 20% of cases, after you write that first check and run the growth project, we find that we have lots of conviction about those teams. We love their hustle. We think they're working in a great market. We'll then concentrate a much larger check at that stage, between $100,000 to $750,000, whereby those companies will become a core position in our fund. We'll commit to getting them through their Series A financing. So it turns out that when you focus on hustle as your primary heuristic, it becomes a natural normalizer of finding those who hustle well versus those who don't. So those who make our core position checks, those concentrated larger checks after that $25,000, are about 38% women, 27% underrepresented groups, 61% outside of Silicon Valley. It looks increasingly more like the populations of the markets that we're serving every day. Because great hustlers look like anyone and come from anywhere. I mean, some of them have great pedigree, some of them don't, but all of them consistently have the same through line of just being able to build and execute extremely well into exciting markets. So that's kind of how we're trying to address our version of a slightly more meritocratic model, is like these checks and balances systems. You know, like the big problem, frankly, of me being able to write checks out of the gate is frankly my eyes. Like I, Eric Bond, am too racist and sexist to actually make objective views of who is a great hustler or not just from the first meeting. I've been conditioned growing up in a very rich part of Michigan, went to rich kids' school like Stanford, worked at rich kids' places like Facebook and Instagram. There's such a myopic view of people that I was surrounded with who are largely those with tons of privilege. And I can't trust myself, frankly, on just like first meeting. But when you begin to work with the teams and actually see the hustle and execution, that's when everything changes, right? Yeah. And so that's what gets us excited in terms of our view of inclusivity and like how we think we can assess for teams early on is through this model of let's just work with the teams and see how it goes.
That's fantastic.
Eric, I love how you're telling us about, you know that you're inherently biased, et cetera. I know that you rely on a lot of women in your life. Lolita, Elizabeth, and your wife, Beatrice Kim. Can you tell us a little bit more about your wife? I know that she's one of your idols practically, that you are, your greatest triumph is marrying her, and she is a diversity inclusion coach. So we would love to hear more about your story, how you met her, and why you are so enamored with this woman.
Yeah. Are you going to email this to my wife, by the way, after this recording? just at least a snippet?
Okay. Absolutely.
All right. Perfect.
If she subscribes. She has to subscribe.
All right. Beatrice, pay attention to the next few minutes here. So, the biggest lottery ticket I ever got in my life was actually happened from the very first week of college. So in the first week of college, I actually met Elizabeth and Sheehan, my two co-founders here at Hustle Fund. So that's been a 21 year friendship at this point. Wow. We're very close to each other's spouses. Our kids are similar ages, each have a boy and girl. At different times, we're co-investors, co-founders of businesses together. It's really rich history. But the very first day of college, so I'm flying from Detroit Metropolitan Airport to California, one of the longest flights I ever took in my life until that point. Land in SFO, you know, my parents are with me. We have like two boxes of stuff, you know, so I load up and go to my dorm room at Robley Hall, freshman year at Stanford. And then I'm like, I should probably meet my neighbors, right? So I knock on the first door to the right of my dorm room. And the first person I meet is my wife. Probably within the first hour of college, I met my wife, right? Wow. Now at the time she was dating some of the jackass that she dated for three more years. But like she left an impression of me. I'm just like, you know, wow, look at this hottie. And then like, you know, we took some classes because I'm like, wow, she's brilliant. So you know, by our junior year is when we started dating. So as of this this next month, that's coming up, April 2021, as of next month, we've been together for about 18 years.
Whoa.
And I actually do think that there's a real difference between life before my wife and life after my wife. So the thing that really impresses me about Bea is, Beatrice is her name. Yeah, so she's primarily a life coach. She works mostly with women who are in tech that are kind of stuck in their lives, you know, trying to find a balance between their marriage, their kids, their careers, and trying to find ways to get unstuck and understanding what they're actually chasing. That's a big part of her business. She also does a lot of diversity and inclusion coaching through a company she started called Awaken with an incredible co-founder named Michelle Kim. The thing that I really love about B is she's always challenged me in two ways. One, very early on, she really impressed this notion of define your values. Mm-hmm. You know, just naturally, she kind of like loves this stuff. So like literally write them down of like, what does the ideal person look like? There's a song that, and this is a bit of a random tangent, but there's this like song that I heard many years ago by the soul singer named William Bell. It's called The Three of Me, right? And I thought actually it really encapsulates well, like the goal of this exercise. So in his hook under the song, The Three of Me, he says, last night I had a dream that there were three of me. There is the man I was, the man I am, and the man that I want to be. And the really amazing thing is like when you define your values, it's essentially creating the blueprint of the man or woman or person that you want to be, right? And measuring like your daily activities, your choices against this person, over time, it actually makes the man that you want to be or person that you want to be closer to the person that you are today. And I really do credit B for like bringing me through this journey. The second thing too about B, I'll just sort of explain this in actually the formation of Hustle Fund. So I was an active angel investor for many years, along with my wife. We did these investments together. We had a pretty great portfolio before we started Hustle Fund. You know, we were like marked like well into tens of millions of dollars at that point with our investments. And when I started Hustle Fund with Elizabeth, I said to my wife, who was at the kitchen table at the time, I'll never forget this, I said, hey, me and Elizabeth have this idea for a fund that we think is going to marry inclusivity with huge capital gain, right? And I walked her through the way that we're going to invest. And I said, you know, what would really make this project happen is if we warehouse all of our best angel investments into the fund at cost. And then we would then be able to pitch something to LPs that had guaranteed winners, meaning like companies like Webflow. Like I was the second investor in Webflow at $20,000. At that point, the deal was worth $330 million or something. We invested like a $3 million post. Like we sold that for $20,000 into the fund. NerdWallet, we sold for, you know, $15,000 into the fund. Like these are like our best winners. Yeah. And in addition to that, I said like, also like, because we need to spend money like and invest as we're fundraising, we need to get another mortgage on the house. So her response to all this was, I think this is a great idea. You should totally do this. Like never was she hesitant about any of this stuff. Like she didn't ask questions like, are you foregoing like all this money for our kid? Like it wasn't those kinds of questions, because she always challenges me to 10x or 100x my ideas. The secret weapon to my life is basically my wife actually is the tailwind that pushes all of my best ideas and all of my ambition. And she tries to make them bigger. Right. Yeah. So this is actually like the incredible outsized influence that she's had in my life. It's just like, I feel like I have much better values because of her. So I'm a better human as a result of her. And also just like anything I do, like she just pushes me to think way bigger than I think I could do myself. So like 99% of all my life successes is credited, I think, just because I found my soulmate as an 18-year-old back in 2000.
That's amazing. So I feel the same way, and Bree and I have had many conversations like this about my wife. I think sacrifice with, you know, my, you know, goals and my dreams in mind is something that Laura has never ever wavered on. It sounds like Beatrice is the same way.
Yeah, amazing.
And you know, I honestly completely agree with you. I think post, you know, me pre Laura, post Laura, totally different people.
Yeah.
And me post Laura is a much better human being generally.
Vic is pretty nice. We all love
him. Yeah. 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 It sucks for all the people who knew me before Laura, but, yeah. You know, frankly, It's crazy. I wish I had had that lottery ticket early on life. You know, now you just kind of, it's all about maximizing the time that you do have, you know, with them once they are in your life. But
yeah,
that's cool. What is life at the dinner table like when you're, do you ever turn off or do you assess deals with her? Do you like that deal flow back and forth and talk about things constantly?
Well, we do have like family values here. So usually around the dinner table specifically, our top family value is quality time and quantity time. It has to be both. So, you know, around dinner, like we have no devices. It's just like, and we rarely talk about work. It's more about, you know, like discussing black holes with my son or with my daughter. Like she's really into Peppa Pig and just talking about debriefing episodes that we see. So there's a lot of that. But when it comes to my wife, so she actually ran with me as a late co-founder, my very first company for 9 years out of college. So we had a working relationship for quite some time, and it was incredible. I would definitely start another company with her again in the future. So she's really, really strategic. And so I really love the fact that I can relate to her about this stuff. We talk a lot about our values and our marriage and our families and all that jazz, right? But like I can come to her with some pretty interesting like problems of like, ugh, we're dealing with this crazy conundrum. Like, how would you weigh these kinds of things? And it's really cool, like, to just talk business with my wife. But in some ways too, like, our family is strange because we treat a lot of our relationships, even with our children, like business too. So we have like quarterly check-ins, annual reviews, you know, like just with our kids. Like we like talk about business models quite a bit with our kids too, because my son loves money. So like, I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing. So just like, yeah, giving them ideas, like how do you like earn money? Like what, like getting some semblance of like cost per acquisition and like scalability and things like this. Like it's, it's really fun that we can both have different kind of perspectives on teaching this stuff because it's relevant to our existing work.
I had a friend whose dad did the same thing, one-on-ones every Monday and then quarterly check-ins.
Well, I mean, like the great thing about quarterly check-ins is like it sets the tone very clearly of just like, we're going to do this to actually have like a deep check-in about how happy we are with the current state of our family values, right? So every idea is on the table, right? And then when we get in there, it's like people are kind of primed, even my six-year-old son, of just like, well, I have these like concerns, you know? And like, I have like these other things that I would love to see our family do instead, right? So one, like the best part is like, we just started to do this with our son who's old enough now. And like, he's got, and like the values are printed out on and framed in our dining room. And we do this every year. So like, at least like the rewriting of it. And so there's like a bunch of things around like play and discuss Star Wars more often is like his core value right now. I'm like, this is great. Like, you know, let's just add that and then, you know, have this on the record. So we do quite a bit of Star Wars discussion these days too.
I like though that that's a value because I think that a lot of people don't understand that values, there's a lot of ways you can define values, including like how you spend your time and money is what you value, right?
Sure.
If you value spending time playing Star Wars, that's a value.
It is. I mean, like, it's not quite the values that we would define with like our adult friends, but the fact that like, you know, you can at least have them think about this stuff, you know, like as, you know, when we were kids, and I'm going to speak for all three of us, like in the 80s and 90s, I don't think that our parents were actually talking about this kind of stuff usually.
No.
It was very, very uncommon to have like social contracts with their children and things like that. But nerdy ass people like us now, when it comes to like younger folks, the people in our lives, like I think it's like a little bit more normalized.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to see like, does this actually make this generation better, right? Yeah. Like, is it or not, or has no initial positive, negative, I don't know. But it's less uncommon for me now to encounter other parents of my age who kind of have these kinds of similar checkpoints, and I love it.
I mean, look, I think when Eric, you and I were growing up, particularly, you know, my dad was he was just busy. He was a serial entrepreneur. He was at a startup 90% of the time,
he worked in a different state for some period of time too, right? And I think, did you describe
he was in and out. So, but he was, you know, he was just always cranking away, right? And he loved my sister and I, certainly, but, you know, his work was his biggest focus. And I am seeing a lot of my friends that I grew up with that also had serial entrepreneurs for parents, they have a similar experience where we really bonded together as a group of friends versus having our dad or mother be very close in that friend category. And I think what that has instilled in my friends who have kids is this undying attitude towards being more present in their kids' life, right? More
it's
present.
Like a, it's a reversion, right, to the mean almost. Right. I think we over-index on that in some ways.
And I doubt your kids are, you know, particularly your older son is saying, okay, I've got my quarterly report with my dad. I think it's more like you've developed a framework with which to say, hey, I'm going to give some consistency and some frequency and a cadence to how I connect with my child. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I doubt, you know, I think some people are going to listen to this and go, oh, that's, that seems a little bit too structured, but I really don't, to me, that feels like you're thinking about it. Right. And I think that's a really genuine kind of cool approach to that.
I also feel like your children are being heard. And like, I know this sounds weird, but, you know, we're going through this huge kind of social change where children used to be seen and not heard. And then now they have access to social media. And so being heard is very easy. You have a democratized platform to talk about yourself. And so I think it's really important that children do listen, or parents do listen to their children now, and really are more aware of their emotional states and do give them a voice in family decisions, because ultimately your kids are going to demand it anyway.
I think that is like a really big difference probably between how we were raised in our generation versus what like the younger folks who are coming out of us are actually experiencing. And that, yeah, just making sure that my son feels really heard, especially him right now, because like he's the most expressive versus my daughter, who's now getting there really quick. It's I can see the change, right? Like when he's really angry at me, but can it use his words to describe it, right? Those are some of my proudest moments, right? Where I'm just like, this is great, man. Like, I know it's painful for you to describe this, but this is just like such an incredible skill to have with people. So it's hard though, right? I mean, like some of these problems, you're just like, dude, I could just fucking solve this for you right now. Like, this kid's an asshole. Right. Like, no problem. I'll call my parents or something like that. But like, it's exciting, right? I mean, like, it's a cool way of living. They're really neat people. So,
So I want us to move on to our first gift, because Vic, one of our biggest things, but this is kind of a flip. I know you're conditioned to think every time a Brooklyn box comes to you, it's for Eric, but this one is the first gift is actually for your wife, B.
I retrieved it. It says box W here. Don't open. So don't I have open. Permission now.
You have permission now.
Okay. Let me pull out my trusty pocket knife.
Also, this is still Drinks with a VC last time I checked. So everyone, including my co-host, please drink. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. So the card that I just pulled out says Mrs. Bond. Let's go ahead and take a look at what this says.
Mm.
By the way, she goes by Mrs. Kim. She did not take my last name.
Well, okay, then you can just throw that envelope.
Oh my gosh. $200 to La Belle Day Spas. That is way too generous. Thank you so much.
Well, she deserves it because obviously she's spas. One of your biggest inspirations and she supports you wholeheartedly. Wow. So she deserves a little something from the Drinks with the VC folks.
That is so nice of you guys. I really, really appreciate this. She's gonna be over the moon, and I'll make sure that all of you guys are well credited for us. Actually, forget that. I'm just gonna say why would I give it away, right? This is amazing. Thank you so much for this La Belle spa gift card. This is so generous and perfect for her too.
So there is something for you. We didn't get to pack it because, well, it's just too big. It was a hammock.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
You know, what was the thinking behind that? I mean, don't get me wrong. Yeah, I am through the moon. I'm going to install this tonight, but it's super over the top.
Well, so we know that sleep is very important to you. And in our pre-podcast call, You noted that you like 9 hours of sleep and plenty of naps.
Yes.
This is to indulge your napping. You know, life is good. You raised fun too. You're off and running. So take a moment, set up the hammock and just zen out a little bit. Get in your safe space.
I already have the spot right there. So it'll be right behind me, you know, in between podcasts like this. I'll sure to snooze and dream about Vic and Bree.
So look, you know, again, life is good right now.
sure.
But, good. Hang out but with guys. It's hard to think, you know, that we've had the pandemic, we have volcanoes going off in Iceland, we've got you know, big tankers running afoul in the Suez. And we've got tons of it feels like the signs of an apocalypse are near.
End of days.
And we know, Bree and I personally, from talking with you and spending time with you, we know that you're prepared. So we've set up a little segment that we like to call How to Survive the Apocalypse with Eric Bond.
I have a lot to say here. Thank you.
Yes. So we're excited for this segment. Like a lot of them, they're one and done, but I think our listeners are going to get an earful here. We're going to show you two options, and you are going to choose the option that you would select for survival. Okay, we're going to give
this
you
actually a speaks quick... my heart because I am a closet survivalist, which I'm coming out of the closet for. So let's do this. This is gonna be
let's
really
do
fun.
This. And it's a short segment, but I think you're going to really enjoy this. Here we go.
Okay, I'm ready.
During the apocalypse, do you run and make shelter in a forest, or do you barricade yourself in your house?
Absolutely barricade myself in the house. Yeah, because there's a lot of water supply here. I would immediately make sure that I use my water heaters, 80-gallon tank. I would fill up any bathtubs if there's any fresh water right now. I have a lot of canned food and Clif bars, and I also have weapons. So I think the safest thing to do is to use the space that I'm most familiar with, barricade ourselves in, and then have like rotating watches with my wife to make sure that we don't have interlopers like Vic coming in to take our Clif bars.
Yes. Yeah.
And maybe if he does try to foolishly come, we'll put him on the spit, smoke his meat, and then survive that much longer for about a month or so off Vic meat.
Off of Vic meat. Okay. Yeah. Fair. Well, thank you. And drink to that.
Okay. Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So barricading.
All right. This next one. Would you choose a shotgun or a machete? As your survival element. You only have one tool weapon to choose out of the two.
That's a good one. So I have both in my house.
Okay. All right.
But I think I would go with machete. So at the end of the day, you know, shells run out. But the knife actually can last quite a long time. And I do have a book on how to create snares and traps to get like the woodland game, like the wood rats, possibly some rabbits if we're lucky. So the knife will be far more helpful, I think, in trapping food than the gun. So I'm gonna go with the knife. Yeah.
Got it. Well, that's disappointing to hear. You have to drink more, and you have to do that while opening up box labeled S.
Okay, let me walk over to box labeled S. Yeah. Just give me 1 second.
It'll all be clear once you open the box.
Okay, so I'm coming back with a box that's 1 foot by 2 foot wide. It's pretty large. Let me take out my trusty pocket knife and open the box. Okay, let's see what box label S says. Includes. Oh, okay, here we go.
You want to put out a presentation?
Shooting guns, shooting gloves. I love this.
Okay.
This is a Browning Browning branded shooting gloves. I really like this. This would be good for duck hunting in cold. I got a recoil pad. This is a really clever device, actually. I have a pretty nice shotgun that controls recoil very well, but I think actually this is going to be something I'm very eager to try next time, because the 12 gauge is a little bit too hard on my wife's shoulders in particular. And Vic's very soft shoulders too, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, and yeah. Oh my gosh, is this a vest, a shooting vest?
Well, yeah, I love this
to hold my shells.
Other vest, you know.
Oh my gosh, yeah, it's not vests. A Patagonia, which is what I was expecting, but a Browning shooting vest. My goodness, this is really nice. I've been always wanting to get one of these before. Thank you so much. And of course, it includes a card. Oh no, it's from the Coyote Valley Sporting Clays shooting range, which is the spot that Brooklyn is very kind to host us every quarter. And it includes a $200 gift card. This is too much, guys. Thank you so much. You truly know the path to my heart. Cheers. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Vic, Ren.
Cheers. Josh. You better take Vic and he'll kick your butt like you kicked mine when we left.
I'm afraid to take Vic. Boy. So true story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get this on record. Last time we went, he blew us all away. I think he had something greater than a 90% accuracy in shooting down clays. Did you get 47 out of 50 or something in your last race?
It was up there. I, you know, I don't like to brag. And
he destroyed every single participant, including myself. Yeah.
I do know this, that Asian Americans and inclusive of Southeast Asian Americans, such as myself, we do have, you know, our brethren in the Olympics that do quite well in shooting in archery. So I feel like that is, you know, you're Korean, I'm Indian, and I feel like we have those backgrounds. We're just naturally good at that, at shooting.
I think there's some pretty good history amongst our people genetically. Comes to those kinds of sports. Yeah. I'm not going to be dunking over LeBron.
Yeah.
But can I do this? Pull back an archery bow and
the you know, absolute focus and body control to shoot.
There's also this quality in Koreans called the Han quality. It actually translates to this innate fire and anger that's built up within us, that we love revenge and those kinds of violent activities. So it does speak to me. Yes. It's called the Han. So Koreans and Korean people are actually called Hanguk people. And the Han part of it is, there's a lot of meaning behind it, but part of Han culture is this innate anger and revenge that drives us. So anyway, not to scare your listeners too much, we should probably proceed with the next question.
Let's go to the next question. And this is going to be a tough one. I really do think this is going to stump your brain here a little bit. For the listeners, we've got a Tesla Cybertruck on the left-hand side, and we've got
Toyota Previa.
Toyota Previa, the gold version, 4x4 sport turbo package.
Oh God!
Which do you choose in an apocalypse to get where you're going fast, or slow? Oh,
gosh, this is such you really truly have done your research. So one of the things that I'm really proud of is just how much I love minivans and talking about minivans. It's very on brand for me. The Previa is looks like a late 90s Previa. That's actually kind of maybe the heyday of Toyota producing these Previas. Lots sold. Vic probably grew up inside one of those too. I certainly did.
Yeah.
So to surprise to my own kind of listeners, those who the five people that follow me on Twitter, is I would go with the Cybertruck. So,
wow.
I actually put down a deposit for one, and I love this. So, you know, even though I am a diminutive Asian guy, I am actually from the Midwest, and I love trucks so much. I don't own one right now. I have a Honda Odyssey and a Honda Accord, but I do want to get one of these Cybertrucks. When I saw this thing, I was just immediately enamored by them. One, because it has this, the dumb kind of survivalist qualities of bulletproof, you know, single mold steel casing with like the, you know, the bulletproof glass, and that stuff is just nerdy cool. But what I really loved about this too is like the ultimate camper vehicle. So it's got run flat tires, which I really love. And also I heard that there's a solar panel cab that you can get that will charge your Cybertruck 30 miles per day if you just leave it outside. That's rumored, maybe not confirmed. So like if I'm going to go full survivalist mode, I'm going to load up all the gear in the back, drive out into like overlanding country and somewhere in California, and then just sort of wait it out, try to find some spring water, woodland game in my Cybertruck with my family, guns, knife, and then we're gonna make it through that season. That's maybe we'll pick up Vic and Bree along the way because you guys are kind of on along the way.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for that. Yeah. We do appreciate it. Cheers to that. I did not think we would find a comparative vehicle that you would take over the famous minivan.
I'm also embarrassed to admit it because like so many people associate me with minivans, so many being like the tiny portion of people who care about tech Twitter and VC Twitter who actually follow us. But like, I love our minivan, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But the Cybertruck is next level.
I do believe I saw the photo of the camper that goes with it.
Yes.
And it did look pretty dope. Yeah, it did look pretty dope. I will say that.
Yeah, it'll be a good trip for you, me, and Bree to take.
Love it. Yeah, we'll go to Shotgun Range together. Exactly.
We'll use my gift cards afterwards. We'll go to La Belle Spa because I have $200 of credit there.
We can These gifts aren't for your wife and for yourself.
Do I need to share them with the rest of us? Gifts, really?
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't really know how many people are listening to Drinks with a VC, so we can probably get away with it. We can get away with it. So on that, you know, we don't have the hookup at Tesla yet. And Tesla, if you're listening,
actually, we're here. We know Ira.
We do know Ira. He's on the board. Yeah, sure. So shout out to Ira. We got to have him on the show. But thank you, Ira. we do need like a real Tesla hookup. So we'll see. But in lieu of the Tesla hookup, we do have a box for you to open. That's connected to it. Yeah, it's the box E.
Yeah, let me go ahead and head over there. It's very heavy, please. And large, so I'm going to cut it over there. Just give me a second.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. What the heck? Wow, so, be still my heart. Yeah. You guys created a bug out bag for me, huh?
We did. And, you know, okay, look, the apocalypse is probably not near, but an earthquake may just be around the corner, particularly in California, where you're rooted down. So, you know, in the case of an emergency, stop, drop, roll, and get to your bug out bag with the family.
This is incredible. Thank you so much. This is it's a comfort for supply guide from the Sustained Supply Company. I've never heard of this before, but the goods inside just contain like a lot of water, food, dehydrated food. Yeah, this is a fire starter. This is amazing. I actually really needed something like this for our vehicles because, you know, I got to get the Honda prepared.
Yeah.
Before the Cybertruck comes. This is amazing. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, and Ren just said
four. Yeah.
He's a family four for 72 hours. No problem. Wow, I am so thrilled by this. You guys like really know me very well. I'm impressed. I'm kind of scared, actually.
Drinks with the VC is like where you get to get drunk and have Christmas morning.
Yes, it should be just Christmas with a VC.
It's really good. Yeah. I appreciate it. These are incredible gifts.
Yeah. So look, let's switch gears a little bit. You told us in our questionnaire that your superpower is storytelling. You also co-host a podcast with Lolita Taub. It's called First Pitches. It's also co-sponsored by Birkeland. So quick pitch, I'm a company man or so. And you know, you mentioned that you recently reached the 10,000th pitch or deal that you've evaluated since 2017. That is a lot of deals. I know that because I think I'm averaging 3,000 per year. So I'm in awe. Very cool. That is a lot of pitches. What is and that's over since 2017. What's the biggest trend that you're seeing amongst those pitches, if you're going to identify one thing?
I think it's hard to distill this, but the quality of the pitches, I think, is increasing. So
yeah.
I'm really pleased to see that there is actually some level of democratization of information online. Happens through the tweets that all three of us are producing in our respective companies, events that we're putting together. Just the quality of information, I think, is really improving. Therefore, I think the quality of the pitches are being reflected. So it's really nice to see that founders are taking a pretty highly sophisticated approach to how they try to explain their businesses. So that's, I think, one, which is essentially makes their jobs harder to discern, like, you know, companies that we're really excited about because all the pitches just seem really good.
Sure.
In terms of other trends, I mean, like that happens year to year, but there's always like a hot thing, like creator economy, NFTs seem to be some, ed tech seem to be really hot this year in particular. But I think I'll just end with like share this, which is just, I get very excited that it's hard for me to discern who is like a Silicon Valley founder versus someone that's in a different part of the world, right? They all essentially look the same now in terms of the quality of the pitch. And that gets me so excited that like, it's not necessarily an activity that's localized to our region in the San Francisco Bay Area where the three of us live, but that Silicon Valley, I think, is really extended across the rest of the world. It's more of like a mindset. So seeing that trend makes me enormously happy because I'd love to see more builders all around the world.
And I think people are getting better at storytelling. But you know, you're a prolific investor and our job is to look underneath that storytelling.
Sure.
Right. And underneath the hood a little bit. And you mentioned, I think really quite insightfully, and your model at Hustle Fund is very different in terms of that initial 25K check and then working with them and then investing in those winners that perform and execute. How else do we do that, right? Because there is, you know, there's the storytelling and the pitches. And look, you look at Y Combinator, of which you're very highly rated, right? Hustle Fund is tops of the list by Y Combinator founders and their internal polls.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you're up there. You're up there. I don't know.
Wait, are you a YC alum yourself, Vic? Did you do YC earlier in your life?
I did not, but we've got quite a few YC alum in our venture advisory network and around town. So here's a question, right? Like YC's class was the biggest ever, right? Their demo day was massive and huge. Everyone was very good at storytelling.
Yeah.
But how do you diligence companies?
We don't.
You know, and you don't?
No. I mean, like when we're writing that first check, it's just a bit on the ideas.
Yeah.
So like the true due diligence is actually when we work with the teams.
Yeah.
Now like the things I do look for are kind of like the classic things. I test for team, problem, solution, market, and traction, which I view as to be like the five key pillars of like a really good seed story. Mm-hmm. And you know, I want to understand like why does this founder seem uniquely qualified to solve this problem? Like how do they arrive at this problem? What kind of customer development? Like all sort of like there's some classic things, but I just need to be 60% convinced in order to write that 25K check. And then it's really in the course of that growth project and working with these teams for some period of time where we can get to 95% conviction, which allows us to get to justify writing that second larger check.
Yeah.
Right. But it's really tricky work, but like we have like mechanisms at least to write and do lots of these kind of small flyer checks.
Sure.
Into teams that we don't have like 100% conviction into yet. So like the bet that we're making is that we are just never going to be smart enough to ever find a pattern match in any of these companies without working with them. So let's at least like invest in a lot of them and then have the opportunity to hopefully write another check later after we see the work. But I think that's like kind of like the biggest thing is just like we are never chasing like a pattern match because it just changes too much.
Sure.
I mean, like these industries, I don't even like NFTs wasn't like really discussed that like 2 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Non-fungible tokens have been around in crypto for, I guess, since whatever, but like these kinds of concepts are very different. And those who are like participants in certain kinds of sectors, they just are evolving quite a bit. So like we just come from a place that we're just too dumb to figure this out ourselves up front and let's just work with the teams.
So who do you think the onus kind of lays on? From an investment standpoint, for companies like Theranos and Ubiome and, you know, others that have, you know, taken a lot of investor capital and have famously been fraudulent or.
It's a tough one, man. I mean, like, so there are certain areas where I'm just like pitching vaporware is okay. Like when I ran like an enterprise SaaS company in earlier in my life, like we were really clear about like, we're developing this thing right now, but I would pre-sell products all the time. And you know, it was a software. So if I didn't ship it, it was just like, well, they didn't get their software and I guess they'll just get their money back. No one was harmed. The thing that's like really tricky in the cases like Ubiome and Theranos is just like vaporware never works in life sciences. Like people will die if you just do this wrong or like serious medical consequences. So from an ethical line perspective, I'm just like, that's where I draw it. I'm just like, when you're playing with people's lives here, like you can't do vaporware kind of stuff. If it's just like janky software where no one's going to get killed if it doesn't get shipped, I'm a little bit more lax. Like, I think it's a different kind of code of ethics of just like, sure, try to sell before you build. That's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like, I guess like, I mean, in terms of who is liable for this stuff, it's definitely the founders, like if you're pitching like a fraudulent thing. But I do think that the investors have some culpability too. I mean, if you're dealing with something that is material to people's lives, there's a different kind of level of conviction, I think, that needs to happen. That said though, like maybe I'm gonna eat my own words, who knows? I mean, like we have a very large portfolio here. Let's see if that ever happens to us. But we generally avoid those kinds of life and death businesses.
Look, to be real, everyone is going to have portfolios where, particularly on the early stage, where there aren't customers they can call, and there aren't, you know, there aren't those indicators that you can see or the red flags that can even exist. If it's so early, really, it's not on you to necessarily find that out. I almost feel like, you know, and not to place it on seed stage and Series A folks, but I do think that there is a level of diligence that we have to strive for that we aren't quite doing as yet across the board, right? And to that extent, and to that point, speaking of companies that have not, speaking of the absurd. We'd like for you to open up box labeled V.
So I'm pulling over, bring this over here, box the V. Yeah. It appears to be a love. Oh my gosh, you're kidding me? Okay, so it's really funny because I just tweeted not too long ago, which Vic and Bree must have seen, that I don't own a single Patagonia vest. And lo and behold, I got a Juicero Patagonia vest. How the hell did you guys find this thing?
We don't find, we make. That's a good question.
We do. So that is a one-of-a-kind Juicero-branded Patagonia vest.
Is this real? Like, is this actually from the company, or did you?
It is not real. And, you know, we know that you would appreciate the irony of that vest and wear it with ironic pride. As our listeners may or may not know, Juicero was a startup that famously raised $118 million from VCs like Google Ventures and Kleiner Perkins. Look, it didn't turn out well for anyone. Here's to... You know, I think there is something to be said about the story that they were able to tell. And I'll tell you what, I've never been more impressed with a podcast that teaches entrepreneurs and gives them sort of a guiding light into how to be better storytellers than the one that Eric and Lolita have put on. And for that single purpose, we thought that you'd really enjoy that in an ironic way necessarily, but
no, it's wonderful. Thank you. You know what really kills me right now is how fucking comfortable it is. And like, I'm so anti Patagonia vest. I love the company actually and what it represents, but just like the fraught nature of these vests.
Yes.
This is actually super nice. I am like, it kind of gets me a little bit, and I guess I'm now Patagonia vested I feel like I made it. It's like my welcome to the VC world. Thank you so much for you both.
Hey, Ma, you made it. Cheers to you.
Oh, thank you. Cheers. I'm going to wear this all day today.
And then you're going to throw it out and put it in a campfire.
No, I can't. I mean, the level of irony is just like, it speaks to my heart. This is just, I'm going to wear this all around town.
I love it. Love it.
And you're one of two VCs who got two vests. So you got your Hunter's vest and your Patagonia vest.
Oh my gosh, you're right. I can wear my gun vest over my Juicero double vest. It.
You can double vest
two
it.
Collars, not one.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's going to be hard to, you know, my wife's going to have some problems. I just like, you know, walk around town with a double vested VC.
You and double popped collars, right? You can really play into a lot of stereotypes.
Oh my gosh,
here.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is fantastic.
Stanford and my Cybertruck.
That's right. And yeah. Walking out of the Cybertruck, that's fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. Look, we've had such a great time with you and really enjoyed the conversation. As is fitting and as we always do, we'd like for our guest, Eric Bond, to send us out with a toast of his own. The next 30, 60 seconds are yours.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much. And I think I want to dedicate this to just this team. So Vic from Green Cow, Bree, Ren, Josh from Brooklyn. You know, one of the things I really love about, again, this vintage of VCs, those who are serving this ecosystem, is that we have a really different kind of social contract when it comes to working with founders, working with each other, where it just feels much more multi-turn transaction. There's actually something that my colleague Sheehan taught me a long time ago, which was you can either treat life as a single-turn transaction or multi-turn transaction. So a single-turn transaction would be like, I'm trying to sell my Honda Accord to Vic. We're going to try to screw each other really badly on price because we're never going to see each other again, right? It's just like a used car sale, goodbye. But you know, one of the values that I really appreciate are folks who do take a multi-turn transaction view of life, which are those who want to build long-term relationships, really care deeply personally and professionally about the person. And that's something that has just been manifest in all of my interactions with Vic, with Bree, with Ren, with Josh to date. So I think that the founder ecosystem is super lucky to have you all as part of contributing to it. And I am very lucky as well as a recipient, as a friend of you all too. So I just want to say cheers to you guys and wishing you all the best with this Drinks with a VC initiative here too. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Eric. Cheers.